Well, why don't we assemble again, ladies and gentlemen?
With Bill this morning, he said, he's really fucked up. But I think he said he's going back to Tenino and maybe coming back tomorrow. So I think we'll just stick with our plan and then see what happens. So, you know, we're really. Here's Don Rick. Do you know who that fellow is talking with Bev, my wife, at the back? You know who the guy is with the brown jacket?
Can we use that mic over there as an audience mic on the very end?
Yeah, if...
People seem to be wanting to use it, so I removed the floor mic and put that on.
Yeah, sure, fair enough.
Okay.
Excuse me, Ann, there's a vacant spot here. Why don't you move there with, Frank Peterson, and all we've seen is his name tag for 3 days. Maybe we should begin again, ladies and gentlemen. This is just to remind you that this is the third day of an examination of the goals that people had at the time of ANCSA, and we've had a wide-ranging discussion about those goals and the extent to which people, Alaska Natives, still have those same goals today. Tomorrow morning, we will take a good look at the forms of land tenure and institutions, corporate institutions, corporations established under ANCSA, and Walter Parker is going to be presenting a paper to open that discussion, and we will then have a wide-ranging discussion of the problems that and the possibilities that the forms of land tenure and corporate institutions established under ANCSA present. And we think that discussion will take us the next 3 days. And then next week, and we hope that all of you at this round table will remain for that discussion. I don't know whether we'll have to enlarge our round table or not, but if you do remain, we will be most pleased. Then next week on Monday, we have invited some native leaders from the Lower 48 and some scholars from the Lower 48, and Professor Joe Jorgensen of California will be leading that panel, talking about historic USA policy towards Native Americans and how they have grappled in the Lower 48, how Native people there have grappled with these questions of Native land and governance. And then the next session begins on Tuesday. That is, we're having the people from the Lower 48 here starting Tuesday of next week. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. And then Tuesday of the following week, we are going to have the visitors, native leaders from Canada, Greenland, Australia, and Norway, to come here to talk about how in those countries Aboriginal people have struggled with their land claims and their desire, and how far they have managed to succeed in their desire to govern themselves. I only mention that because I don't want anybody to think we're trying to solve all these questions today or even this week or even next week or the week after, because I intend that after these 3 weeks of discussions are over, we will begin another round of meetings in the villages so that Alaska Natives throughout the state can state their view, can have their say about all of this. So I know there's a tendency sometimes to be a little impatient. Why haven't we come up with some solutions yet? We've been here 3 days. Well, I think it's best in a matter as important as this to take a little time and to make sure we understand where we're coming from. And that's why I have appreciated the contributions that all of you have made these last few days, so that we do understand the origins of ANCSA, what it was intended to achieve, and how far it has brought Alaska Natives. Well, today I would like first of all to call on Joe Upikson, then on Byron Malott, and then on Fred Paul to give us the downside of IRAs, and then Martha Dementiev was going to answer David Case's question, and then I thought we might get into some specific questions that David and Rosita and Anne and Chuck would like to raise with you. So, Mr. Upikson, please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to begin with the reason why Arctic Slope Native Association opposed the bill that the President of the United States signed in December 18, 1971. At that time, we told the President of the United States in very strong language to veto that bill. We said that some may think that 962.5 million dollars and 40 million acres of land was a fair settlement. The method, however, in allotting those Aboriginal lands and money was important. The Arctic Slope Native Association said first that the allotment and the money that was being distributed to the Alaska Native was not fair at all. And the reason we gave behind that was that we came into the Alaska Federation of Natives with 56.5 million acres of land. We supported the allocation of land to the area of the region that we had in terms of Aboriginal title. That allotment was all right, but then we went into the money situation where we said that the Claims Act itself should have related to a land transaction. It is a land claim settlement, and we never should have gotten away from that concept. Now, we said that the reason why we were small in population in the Arctic and we claimed Aboriginal title to 56.5 million acres was that the land just couldn't support population. Therefore, we stuck close to the concept of a land loss formula and also a land loss distribution on the money also. We were at that time 5% of the entire population of Alaska Natives. Now, getting into this one man, one concept was not our way of settling for that type of settlement. It was never fair. Now, on the other hand, we had the special group that came from the Tlingit and Haida area who came into the Claims Act saying that they had 2.5 million acres. Now, that is small compared to our 56.5 million acres. But their population is large. Now, we figured that in the allocation of monies, the Tlingit and Haida would be getting 400% more than the Alaska Native in the Arctic, us Inupiat. That is when you start cranking in inflation and the cost of living index in the Arctic. I think that until I can hear further how the other leaders will respond and I can have a better picture and if there's going to be any questions, I feel that I worked very closely with Fred Paul and our counsels at the time to allow me to give you a fair answer. Plus, I'm not winded just like John Borbidge.
Well, thanks, Mr. Hupickson. I think you'll see that by design or by accident, we've surrounded you with people from Southeast. Well, perhaps I could ask you, Mr. Malott, to add something.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll be relatively brief because not having had the opportunity, for which I apologize, of being here earlier, some of what I have to comment on may have been covered. But looking at that period of time from my perspective, particularly the mid-60s, it was a time of hope and expectation, a time when federal policy had come to a point where it seemed to be responsive to the concerns and the aspirations of minority people and the economically disadvantaged in this country. It was a time of the war on poverty, a war in which Alaska Natives certainly had every reason to be involved with. It was a time of economic development opportunity and infrastructural development opportunity for the rural areas of our state. For the first time since whatever the war in the 40s brought, it was a time at which institutions were established that Native people could begin to coalesce around and essentially control and begin to see results from, as far as their economic status was concerned. It was a time in which the social aspirations of a people seemed to have some opportunity for meaningful results. Certainly this window of opportunity and hope and expectation changed by the time the Settlement Act passed and began to change, of course, in 1968 when federal policy once again began to change in a way that should have given considerable pause to us and our attitudes of hope and expectation. One thing that, and I've tried not to think too much in detail about what was happening then. I've tried to, in my thinking, just capture what leaps into my mind as I think about that period. And it's a phrase that we use often, but I think that it's characteristic to some degree of at least how I view another attitude that prevailed at that time. We were able to influence, the Native people were able to influence public policy in a way that you could never have even imagined a decade prior to that time. The land freeze, the village suits that were brought to stop the pipeline, the opportunity to have access and even have your hands on the levers of some considerable power, and the recognition, of course, that because of the issues that were being brought into clear focus very quickly, resulting from the huge discovery of oil on the North Slope, there was this thought that this was an opportunity and a juxtaposition of circumstances and events and time that might never come again. And one of the phrases that we hear now, to which I referred to just a moment ago, that, hey, it's time to get on the train because it's leaving the station. And this was a phrase that was mentioned a number of times during the congressional hearings. It was a time when oil company lobbyists were our friends. It was a time when many powerful institutions, to some degree, shared at least the same short-term goals that we had for a settlement, that is to clear the issue of land title. Of course, our reasons were very different. A number of issues, and Mr. Borbidge and others have mentioned them, were essentially skirted in the Claim Settlement Act. The issue of sovereignty certainly was one major, major issue that was skirted. It was protected, I believe, but it was essentially skirted in at least how it would evolve in the future. I'm not sure it's been mentioned here, and it's been kept relatively quiet over the years, but another major issue in my view that was skirted, if not never addressed by the Congress in the Claim Settlement Act, was the whole issue of water rights, which is still, in my judgment, very much an open issue with respect to Native ownership in the state of Alaska. Another thing that was of visible impact upon me at that period of time was the feeling for the process. That is, for all of the frustration and anger that we sometimes feel, particularly from young people today, and it was certainly amply stated and eloquently stated yesterday in several of the comments that we heard from both those young in age and certainly the young lady who was young at heart, that there were self-appointed leaders. And that really is just the complete antithesis of my understanding and my feeling for what was happening at that time. The process evolved and had its touchstone and its basis in principle on the attitudes and the aspirations of rural people. There was never a major decision made. There was never a major new turn made in the entire process without a strong effort on the part of AFN and other institutions to go back to the villages. As a matter of fact, at least in the timing as the natives were able to influence it in Congress, the desire and the compelling need to obtain the views of the rural people and particularly the elders was critically important to the entire process. And having said that, and I refer also to a comment that was made yesterday by one of the panelists that ultimately it was the board of directors of AFN that made the crucial decisions on behalf of Native people in Washington. That certainly was the case, and we could not have made any forward movement any other way. At some point, you have to make decisions. Which brings me to the point that while there was huge principle involved and certainly overriding in the development of the Claims Act at that time, there was also huge pragmatism, and there was compromise. It was influenced by several things, I think. I think it was influenced by the thought that I mentioned earlier that it's time to get aboard because the train's leaving the station. It was influenced also, I think, by the evolution of the Claim Settlement Act itself. It wasn't a process by which Native people staked out a claim and enunciated it in a way that you could then begin to bargain down from. And I think that the paper captured that clearly. It was natives essentially stating a moral position. that, hey, we can't compromise. This whole thing is ours. So how are we going to make it work? And you took from that the great leap to what ultimately was considered realistic and achievable in Washington. To a large degree, Native people had to throw themselves on the mercy of Congress. That also was a decision that I don't have any real knowledge as to how it evolved. To me, it was almost something taken for granted, but that the way to settle the Native claims was in Congress, not in the courts. We had the example that Mr. Borbidge mentioned just in the previous decade of the Tlingit-Haida settlement, which was in no stretch of the imagination justice. We had the history of Native claims and claims court judgments over the years, which had evolved to almost a rigid position of not allowing land to be a part of any venue in consideration of Native claims. So Congress seemed to be where you had to go. And because of the mood in the nation at that time, Congress was in a mental framework to deal with this issue, not just from the very practical, hard realities that were presented it from everything that flowed from the major discovery of oil at Prudhoe Bay, but flowing from what had happened in this nation in the 60s, the civil rights movement, the huge attitudinal changes that if not having imbued and caught fire in the population as a total, at least infected Congress and the leadership of this nation to a very considerable degree. But there was this attitude and this need for compromise, you know? And the compromise, to some degree, seemed to be one of the natives ratcheting up the ante as opposed to others ratcheting it down, at least if you look at the record itself, from the bills that had been introduced, from legislation that had no land or minimal land. I guess one of the first bills, the total dollar amount was in the $10 million range, and then it was $100 million. And through the hammering and the leadership of AFN at that time, you ultimately got to the point of what were considered significant breakthroughs on our part. And I say our with a capital O because my personal participation was not that significant. And those whose participation was, they know who they are. It was ratcheted up to $1 billion, less 40 million or so, and 44 million acres of land. And so it was a time, regardless of what was happening in the legislation itself, where the big issues allowed us to maintain this sense of hope and expectation, a strong sense that for the first time we might have some real ability to control our destiny as a people. Now, the bill itself, ultimately, in the legislation, was a very, very complex law. And many of us did not read the fine print. And many of us did not do the analysis that the Arctic Slope Native Association did near the end to try to ferret out what this really meant. And the newspapers at the time, with their headlines of natives to get $1 billion and 44 million acres of land, brought hope and expectation, in my judgment, to a fever pitch, which has become one of the most difficult things that we have had to deal with in the implementation of the Claim Settlement Act ever since. Because at about the same time as the passage of the Act, the whole public policy and to some degree public attitudes in this nation began to change, and they have continued to evolve in a direction that is not conducive to minority and Native people achieving or being able to meet the hopes and expectations that they had at that time. The gap between those people with material wealth and those people without it has widened in this period of time. It has not been closed. So we took the act at a time of expectations and hope at a fever pitch, and were ultimately thrown into the business of having to implement it, with the results that have brought us essentially to this point, where Native people have said, hey, where are we? What has this meant? Has it been good for us? To points on one side where people are saying throw the whole thing out and start over, and others are saying give us time, it'll work. But in my judgment also, there were several fatal flaws in the Claim Settlement Act that have to be fixed, and I don't think that they can be fixed within the framework of continuing implementation of the Claim Settlement Act. They're the sort of fixes that you can't do on a moving machine. And two of those, which I think are principal, are the fact that the land was placed into the corporations, that the land was sought for its nativeness values, its subsistence values, its ability to allow every culture has its roots in some geographical place. It is land that molds us more than any other single characteristic. And when I say us, I mean Native people, because there are cultures that have evolved so far from the land that other influences are significantly greater, of course. And the land was placed in the corporations without really an appreciation, I believe, of what the corporations were and what they could do, because the corporations are essentially a business machine. The entire history of their entire history in law, in precedent, in myth, in reality has 99% to do with making money and adhering to the P&L, and maybe 1% the ability to influence and to change and to impact public policy as it affects the social course of a people or a nation. And the land, by that act, by the act of putting the land into the corporations, the land became an economic asset under law, under every other imaginable understanding of what it means to place an asset into a for-profit business corporation. And so immediately we were on a diverging course as to how that land could best be utilized and how best it could be maintained on behalf of Native people for the long-term future, because that's not what the land was for. The land was not viewed as an economic asset. It was viewed as the touchstone and the basis from which Native people could maintain their value systems and their cultures and all those things that have brought us to where we're at today. And of course, the second fatal flaw, in my judgment, was the fact that those born after December 18, 1971 were left out of a direct and clear participation in the Claims Settlement Act. And there's a real irony there because, again, as I understand it, or as I recall, one of the principles that was very much important to developing the Claims Settlement Act at that time was the principle that this Claims Settlement Act has got to benefit not just that generation or those generations of Native people that are alive today because of the accident of time and history, but for all Native people that would evolve after them into the future. And that was one of the reasons for the corporations. And that was one of the reasons that a total per capita settlement was rejected. Somehow, someone ultimately must have said, how can you take $1 billion and maintain its corpus and allow it to become greater? And of course, that's what corporations are all about, hopefully, if they function properly. You know, you put the money in and you make more money. And it wasn't so much to gain economic power, although certainly that's something that Native people need if ultimately they are going to achieve what it is that they want to achieve. But it was because of that sense that, doggone it, somehow we have to make this thing last beyond us. And of course, the irony is that we chopped off from participation in the distribution of that growth and increase in wealth, those very people that we had wanted to do it for. And of course, also, Congress was saying at that time, well, the way that this will be done is by parents transferring stock to the children. And no one really thought about, well, gee, what if you have 5 children and 100 shares? You get to a point of diminishing returns in an awful hurry. And of course, there are all sorts of lateral transfers. Just a review of Sea Alaska's records show that there are a substantial number of lateral transfers of stock out of the family. And so, you know, what in a vague sort of way was understood to be how those born after December 18, 1971 would participate has never really materialized, and that's something that we have to deal with. Just one final comment, Mr. Chairman, if I could, and it's prompted by some of the comments you made at the opening of this session and several comments that I heard and participated in the back as we were getting ready, is this business of when are we going to get to the solutions, you know? Because we transferred all of our hopes and aspirations to the Claims Settlement Act. And the other final fatal flaw, it isn't fatal at this point, but it could be, is that Native people have created, and the Claims Settlement Act has created the opportunity for us to destroy ourselves by having us use our own institutions and fight with our own people without looking outside to where some of the real obligation for our circumstance and for our future lies. The Claims Settlement Act was, as has been emphasized here, basically a land settlement. It became much more than that, certainly. But that's what it really was all about at that time. And what has happened is that many Native people have transferred all of their hopes and all of their aspirations and all of their frustration and all of their anger to ANCSA for reasons that we all can understand as it exists in human nature. But we're ignoring and are not focusing our efforts and energies on those outside institutions and government and elsewhere that have as great an obligation to work with us to get to where we want to go. And I think to some degree that evolves also from the notion that was implicit, if not explicitly stated at that time, that we wanted institutions that we would control, and we wanted to control our own destiny, and that ANCSA was a way to do that. Well, doggone it, ANCSA isn't the way to do that. ANCSA can do certain things, but it can't do everything. And that transference takes place quickly. Mr. Chairman, you may be in that position when this is all done. Where are Justice Berger's answers to our problems? What are Justice Berger's solutions? And you cannot bring us the solutions. Like many other institutions and many other processes, certainly this can be very helpful. But ultimately, we are the ones who have to deal with that problem and resolve it. It will take a lot of involvement on the part of institutions and other outside interests that we will have to influence. And it can't be done ultimately just within the framework of ANCSA, but I think much of the frustration and the anger that we feel today flowed from the hopes and expectations of that time. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Malott. I think everyone is struck by what you've said. It might be appropriate for me to add that this commission is established by two international Native peoples organizations, and its report will be written on the basis of what all of you are saying at these overview gatherings and what people say in the villages. And it will be a document that Alaska Natives can make use of to plan their own future for themselves. I think it's entirely appropriate that you should remind us that that this commission isn't going to be in the business of formulating solutions with a capital S. But I hope that we can, through this process, and here and in the villages, and through the report, be of use to Alaska Natives as they decide where they are going from here. Well, Mr. Malott has indicated some of the what he regards as the flaws in ANCSA. He's pointed out that it was essentially a land transaction, a means for holding and consolidating the land and acquiring economic power through these corporate structures. But he has said that some questions were not intended to be covered by it. Perhaps out of the desire that people in Alaska have to formulate new institutions that deal with the questions that ANCSA didn't address, the idea of strengthening traditional councils and IRA councils has emerged. And Mr. Paul yesterday indicated the advantages of IRA councils. I should say that at the village meetings last week, people did talk about IRA councils, and I urged them to think about what the good and the bad might be of IRA councils, so that they knew what they were getting into before they went any farther along that particular route. And so we asked Mr. Paul if he would this morning, having given a glowing account of the possibilities of IRA councils yesterday and IRA corporations, if he would see if he could find something bad to say about them this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm having a hard time finding the disadvantages. Obviously, I believe in the IRAs, and I think in legal concept, the few disadvantages pale. Under Section 16, the tribal sovereignty section of the IRAs, one disadvantage is that it requires practically an act of Congress to convey land out of the tribe, or even to mortgage it, to make some working capital. However, most IRAs have... Yes, Section 177 says you can't build Section 177, the Non-Intercourse Act of Title 25, says you can't deal with an Indian tribe with respect to its land without being punished. There's a $1,000, it's not a misdemeanor, but there's a penalty to it, and it's a void transaction. But most of these IRAs have two forms of entities. One is the traditional tribal organization under Section 16, but there's also Section 17. And that's where the Secretary of the Interior issues a charter of incorporation. It's a corporate form of IRA. And when one reads the charter from the Secretary, usually there's a provision in the charter authorizing the corporation, Section 17 organization, to transfer real estate. So with some care in managing the kind of organization that is utilized within the IRA,